Tell me a little bit more about Perth during the time of this exclusion zone.
So from 1927 was officially when it was gazetted, and it was set up basically because there was a place called White City, which was an amusement park that had been set up by a group called the Ugly Men's Society, which was made up of ex-servicemen from the First World War who created it to generate income for the children of deceased servicemen. And it was a magnet for Aboriginal people throughout the city and from the countryside, because basically it was the only place that you could go where it was held at night. It was down where the Perth bus station is, down on the river at the moment. And they had buck jumping and boxing competitions and a massive slide. You can see images down there at the Elizabeth Quay at the moment. There's a few sort of memorials to it. Anyway, it became a real focal point, particularly for Aboriginal women meeting other Aboriginal men and non-Aboriginal men. And word of this got to Mr. Neville, who was the chief protector. And so he sent police down there to investigate. And most of their reports were actually quite benign. They said, look, people are happily going about their business. But one of the key things that disturbed Mr. Neville was that Aboriginal men were beating non-Aboriginal men in boxing competitions, which he believed to be a great embarrassment. And so using the 1905 Act legislation, they created the Perth Prohibited Area, which banned people from being in the city after 6 p.m., for which a search of Trove can reveal that quite a few people were actually imprisoned and also fined under that act.
Tell me about the Coolbaroo League.
Well, Coolbaroo came along in the post-war era. So after the Second World War, we saw upwards of 3,000 Aboriginal people serving in the armed forces nationally. Hundreds of Western Australian Aboriginal servicemen served in Papua New Guinea, mopping up operations in Japan. And when they returned, they had mixed with African-American servicemen, other white servicemen from other countries, and they had a greater sense of their own civil rights and felt that they had achieved and fought for their country and deserved those civil rights. So into that mix of returning servicemen were two particular returning servicemen, the Poland brothers from Shark Bay. And in 1942, a young Yari woman who'd been living in Port Hedland, Helena Murphy, well, she's actually Helena Clark at the time, had hitchhiked from Port Hedland down to Perth in 42 to be with her sister, whose husband was serving in the war. And she had tried to join Manpower as an Aboriginal woman, was refused because she was Aboriginal. And she'd looked around and she'd got work here and there, and she decided that there was nothing that was available for Aboriginal people. You weren't allowed to go into pubs. You weren't allowed into dance halls. You weren't allowed. You were often surveyed by the police. There's an amazing file called East Perth Native Matters, in which they're closely watching the population. So Helena got together with the Poland brothers, and they met a group called the Modern Women's Club, which included people like Catherine Susanna Pritchard, and they started up the very first dance, which was held in the city of Perth.
They became quite the political powerhouse, didn't they? What did they achieve?
They did. So from its humble beginnings in 1946-47, it ended up running right through till 1962 and then transformed into other forms of political voice. And in that time, they set up their own newspaper, the West Australian Aborigine. So that was one of the first of its kind, which ran for many years, and it was a really high-quality broadsheet that was produced by all of the League members themselves from their own resources. There was no government funding for everything that they did. And they highlighted issues that they felt weren't being dealt with. So it was about equal rights, voting, citizenship, discrimination. They're also focused, they had one of the first stories to focus on Aboriginal deaths in custody, a man named Jimmy Gwethuna, who had died in Meriden. They made it front page news because they felt that it wasn't being picked up by other news services, and they continued that as a feature article until they had a deputation to the minister. They were able to also do things where the League members would attend Parliament en masse as a block of Aboriginal people, and particularly those who had citizenship papers and could do that. And they would sit there when they knew that legislation that was affecting them was being discussed, so that there was an Aboriginal contingent watching Parliament discuss them. Mm-hmm. And so they were a really vibrant, go-getter group of people. They ran a youth club. They looked at housing for poor families. They had education programs. But the thing that attracted hundreds of people were their weekly dances that they had in the city and their regular dances. They also ran in some upwards of eight country towns throughout the southwest.
You had relatives involved in the league?
Look, I did. My grandmother was involved, Jessie Argyle. She lived here in East Perth and in also in Highgate. And so Nana would bake, as many of the old girls would, for the Coolbrew dances. My mum attended. And so I knew about it as a child growing up because flipping through the photos, there would be these amazing images of aunties and my mum and my father dressed up to the nines in ball gowns at this dance club, you know, Auntie Arlene Harwood and George Harwood from Broome. And so in later years when we were doing oral history projects in the 90s, which were focused mainly on removal stories, people who'd been taken away to missions and to settlements like Moore River, once we dealt with those rather harrowing stories, often people would want to reflect on something positive and they would bring up the Coolbrew dances, and it became such a common theme that we started to investigate it, both in terms of more interviews with something like 30 of the key members and then other archives, and that led to the film, which was produced in 1995.
The release of this podcast is really timely. We know that it's NAIDOC Week. Why do you think it's so important that as West Australians we get to know this story that you're so familiar with but perhaps others aren't?
I think it's because it shows Aboriginal agency. And I think Coolbrew itself is a Yamaji word that means magpie. Now, originally, the people who coined it in 1948 chose magpie or Coolbrew as an identity term. They were sick of terms like half-caste, quarter-caste, octoroon, and these ways in which they were defined by caste and by race. And they chose Coolbrew to mean black and white, people of mixed descent. But over the years, it changed. It came to mean black and white working together. And so by the 1950s, it was, if you like, a really early reconciliation movement. And if there's anything that West Australians need to understand is the legislation that was so draconian and imposed upon Aboriginal West Australians in 1905 through the 1905 Act and its various different acts until 1972, it also served to segregate and to separate non-Indigenous Australians from Indigenous Australians, from Aboriginal Western Australians. So it also affected the non-Aboriginal population. And so if we're going to move beyond that disjuncture, we all need to come to terms with that history.
The podcast is called Untold WA. It's produced by Elsa Silberstein, the City of Perth and Barking Wolf. And you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Steve, thank you very much for coming in and sharing a bit of a taste of what the podcast brings us. Appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, Charlotte.